From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, actress Tandy Newton discusses her role in the new show Westworld on HBO, and singer Ellis Hall talks about his career and his latest symphony project called Soul Unlimited. But first, during the much-anticipated first debate of the election season, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump had an opportunity to convince undecided voters that they are the best choice for president. On today's program, we'll get opinions from both sides of the political aisle about how each candidate performed during the debate and what happens next. Conservative commentator Ann Coulter will provide her analysis later in the show. Former presidential candidate Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont joins me now to share his thoughts. Senator, good to have you back on, sir.
Good to be with you.
Let me say a quick word before we start our conversation. For those who follow me on Twitter, you might have noticed some pretty rabid pro Donald Trump tweets that came out of my account. I should tell you, as we've already said in a few other places, my Twitter account was hacked. Just disregard all those pro-Donald Trump tweets. Just wanted to go on record so that you know that those tweets did not come from me. Having said that, Senator, what did you make of the debate?
Well, my tweets were not positive toward Donald Trump. That's what I could tell you.
Yeah.
What I thought is, you know, I think Clinton won, but I think even more significantly, I think Trump lost. And I think he continues to dig a deeper and deeper hole for himself. You know, Tavis, at the end of the day, a lot of issues out there. But I think most Americans, especially younger people, understand that the history of this country over the last several hundred years has been the fight against bigotry. And we all understand what happened to the Native Americans. We understand about slavery and racism. We understand the discrimination against the Irish, the Italian, the Jews, and other people. Mm-hmm. And what we have tried to do as a nation is bring people together to become a non-discriminatory type of society. And you know what? Many problems remain, but we should be proud that in terms of overcoming sexism and racism and homophobia, we have actually made real progress. And I think most Americans, regardless of their political views, do not want to see us go backwards and are not going to be supporting a candidate for president who has made bigotry the cornerstone of his campaign. We saw that again with the sexism. I don't think the American people want to go there.
You have debated Hillary Clinton as much as or more than most Americans. Was she on her game? How good was she on a scale of 1 to 10?
I think she was very good. And I think the main point, you know, I always worry, you've heard me say this before, Tavis, that the media trivializes politics.
Right.
It was not Dancing with the Stars. It was not the World Series or the Super Bowl. It was about a discussion as to who is going to lead this country and, in fact, be the most important political leader in the world. And I think if you listen to the issues, for example, Clinton is 100% right when she talks about Trump wanting to bring us back to trickle-down economics. Who in their right mind believes that when we have a grotesque level of income and wealth inequality, the number of billionaires has increased 10 times since the year 2000. Trump wants to give the billionaires and the top 1% hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks, by the way, including his own family, a $4 billion tax break. Who believes that that makes any sense at all? And then he wants to throw 20 million Americans off of health care by doing away with the Affordable Care Act. So I think she was strong on that issue. Yes, we still have serious economic problems, but I think any fair-minded person understands that under Obama, we have made real progress in improving the economy. We don't want to go back to Bush's trickle-down economics.
What about his offer, his deal, if you will, to release his tax returns if she released the deleted emails? What did you make of that?
Well, what I made about it is I'm sure they spent a lot of time figuring out their one-liner. But what I will tell you, which was very interesting to me, above and beyond, you know, releasing tax returns, is when he said, when she said, "You didn't pay any taxes." And he said, "Yeah, I'm smart."
Mm-hmm.
Now, just think about that for a moment. You have men and women in the military right now. You have veterans out there. We have kids who need an education. We've got to combat climate change. And this guy says, "No, I think Americans should pay nothing in taxes. I'm a multi-billionaire. Aren't I smart? I didn't pay a nickel in taxes." Wow. What an outrageous statement. That is, for, especially for somebody who wants to lead this country.
Were you heartened by the fact that there were 81 million people watching, or are you like some of us who believe that a lot of that was people tuning in because they wanted to see a train wreck?
Well, I think as we come down to the final weeks of the campaign, you're going to see more and more people understanding the seriousness of this election. Look, it is no great secret. Every poll shows that neither Trump or Clinton are particularly popular. That is what I think everybody understands. But and all kinds of reasons why. But I think if we focus not on Trump, not on Clinton, but on ourselves, on the middle class, on working families, and say, okay, which one of these people will be a better president for the children, for the working families, for the elderly? I think the answer is absolutely obvious. I have differences with Clinton. That's no great secret.
Yeah.
But you got one candidate wants to give huge tax breaks to billionaires and cut programs for working people. The other candidate, Clinton, thinks that maybe billionaires should stop paying their fair share of taxes so we could rebuild our infrastructure, expand child care benefits, and make sure that we improve lives for working families. I don't think that's a difficult choice. This issue of climate change. Tavis, what the scientists are telling us is if we do not get our act together and transform our energy system, the kind of planet we're leaving to our kids and our grandchildren is going to be one in serious duress. Real problems, more floods and droughts and extreme weather disturbances. Donald Trump's position is he thinks climate change is a hoax. He wants more fossil fuel production. Clinton has a serious proposal in terms of how to transform our energy system. So I think on issue after issue, the choice is pretty clear. As the American people pay increased attention, yeah, I think they will side with Clinton.
You were tweeting like crazy, and one of the pictures that's gone viral around the world is the picture of you standing in front of a big screen television watching it. How do we read that photo? Were you sad when knowing that it wasn't you on stage? How do we read that? How do we caption that photo?
Was that sadness really showing in my face?
No, I'm just asking you. I'm asking you, how do we caption that photo?
You know, I'm very proud of the campaign that we ran and the hundreds of thousands of volunteers who, you know, did everything they could. But we didn't make it. If you're asking me, would I have liked to have been up on the stage with Trump? I suspect I would have given my left arm, maybe my right arm, I don't know, what else? Yes, I wish I were up there, but I'm not. And my job now is to do everything I can to see that Trump is defeated.
But let me cut in right quick. Had you been on stage, given that you watched this thing from beginning to end, what openings, I mean, you're like a great NFL running back. What holes did you see that you would have run through that Hillary didn't?
I probably would have ripped them apart on this business of giving tax breaks to billionaires, including himself. I would have gone to climate change.
Yeah.
More strongly than Clinton did. Those are two areas that I would have moved on.
So you have moved closer to Clinton than many of your supporters have. I'm following them and watching them and listening to them every day to see if and when she can turn them around. And of course, what she desperately wants and quite frankly needs are those millennials who still love Bernie Sanders. Did she do anything, or what must she do over these next two debates to pull those young people to her side?
I think the format was a tough format in which to do that. And there was too much back and forth and too much in the way of personal attacks. I will be in New Hampshire with Secretary Clinton. And what we're going to be talking about is a proposal that she and I worked on, which will make public colleges and universities tuition-free for every family in this country earning $125,000 or less, 83% of our population. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty big deal. And also, a major proposal to reduce student debt, which is a serious problem for millions of people in this country. I think we're going to be talking about expanding community health centers, making healthcare more accessible to many millions of people. And I think she has got to also focus on climate change, which is an issue of real concern to many young people.
What do you expect that Donald Trump will do between now and the next debate, given that most people, by and large, think that Hillary cleaned his clock in this first one?
I think what his handlers have tried to do, and we have to acknowledge this, Donald Trump is a entertainer. He had very, very successful television show.
Right.
He is very comfortable in front of a TV camera. That's no small thing as an entertainer. I think what his handlers have tried to do, with success, by the way, in the last few weeks, is keep him on course. So I think their challenge will be stay on the issues that you are strong on and don't don't wander from the script.
Do you think he's capable of doing that? My sense is he started out with, his tone was very different. He was a bit softer. For the first 5 or 10 minutes, he was working their game plan. But I just don't think that Donald Trump has the DNA that would allow him for 90 minutes to maintain that kind of even tone.
Well, you may be right. You know, I'm not a psychologist, so I can't, you know, analyze him. But I think there are a lot of demons inside of this guy, and it's hard to keep them down. And sometimes those demons work for him, but I think often they work against him.
So here's my exit question. Senator, I'm not going to make you a prognosticator, but you're seeing the same polls that I'm seeing. These polls are still tight, and there are those who believe it's going to get even tighter between now and Election Day, never mind these debates. How scared are you that Hillary Clinton, even against a guy like Donald Trump, could lose this?
She could. I mean, let's be frank about it. If anyone thinks that this is a slam dunk presidential campaign, you're not dealing with reality. And I think here's what's going on, Tavis. You got a lot of people out there who are really hurting. And sometimes inside the Beltway, people don't know it. These are people who are working two or three jobs. People have seen their real incomes come down. People worried about their kids, worried about their retirement. They want to shake up the system. They don't think the establishment is working for them. And you know what? They're right. The establishment is not working for them. They want real change. And they see Trump as a bringer of real change. Problem is, in this case, the real change will move our country in the wrong direction. And I would ask all of those people, take a hard look at the candidates. Forget the personalities. You don't like Clinton, you don't like Trump, fine. Take a hard look. Who's going to raise the minimum wage? Who is fighting for pay equity for women? Who is going to deal with climate change? Who is going to make public colleges and universities tuition free? Those are real issues that will impact the lives of tens of millions of people. Clinton, to my mind, is far and away the superior candidate.
Good to have you on. We'll do it again, I'm sure.
Okay, Tavis, thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. We're continuing our analysis of the first presidential debate. Our next guest is the conservative commentator Ann Coulter. She is a New York Times bestselling author. Her latest text is titled, In Trump We Trust, E Pluribus Awesome. She joins us now to share her thoughts. Okay, let's just go. I don't have to ask you any question really at all, except what do you think of the debate?
Well, I've learned from watching the commentary afterwards, apparently I'm supposed to lie in whomever I'm in favor of. I'm supposed to say, whoa, cleaned the field, wiped out. The truth of the matter is, and I think it was a draw. I think Trump won the first half, Hillary won the second half. Okay. And then I watched TV and they're all talking about it being humiliating defeat for Trump. And I thought, well, screw it. Why should I tell the truth?
Yeah. You and I agree on one thing. I think that in the minds of many people, it was a draw. But a draw, not because Hillary didn't win. I think she cleaned his clock with the facts and the data and her performance, her style, the ambiance, all that. I just thought she was better all the way around. But I think it may have been a draw to some people in part because the bar was so low for Donald Trump. He just had to not look like a complete idiot, fall off the stage, yada, yada, yada. And I think, people may disagree, I think he pulled that off. I don't think he looked like a complete idiot. And it is round one. So in that sense, maybe it was a draw.
As I said, I think on Twitter, all he had to do was not look like Hitler.
Yeah.
And, oh, okay, I can vote for him.
Yeah. Bernie Sanders was just on, though. To your reference about Hitler, Bernie's point, his very first answer to me was, and I'm paraphrasing here, that what we saw from Donald Trump was more bigotry, and that we've worked a lot of years in this country to avoid that. And in many of Donald's answers, there was that.
That's crazy.
Undercurrent of bigotry.
What I would say is Hillary was the best I've ever seen her. Whoever her makeup artist is, the lighting was fantastic, and whatever drugs she was taking, fantastic. She looked
drugs.
Healthy.
They said Donald was the one taking the drugs with all the sniffing.
Healthy.
Now you got Hillary doing drugs.
I think he looks sick. Yeah, yeah. He has a cold or an allergy or something. But it was probably Donald Trump's worst performance, and thus ended up being a draw. But why is that? The reason I think it was a draw, and when was Trump good? And this is what annoyed me about his performance. He's good on the issues. I mean, I found it interesting immediately after the debate, everyone's saying, she baited him. Well, what did she bait him into? She baited him into not talking about the issues. He wins on the issues, some of which, mm-hmm. by the way, are Bernie Sanders issues, mm-hmm. and he's being a sissy for going ahead and saying, yeah, I'm with Hillary. Well, what about the trade agreements? I mean, that was what was so great about Trump at the beginning. Whenever he talks about his issues, immigration, the mass importation of jihadists, and the trade deals, bringing the jobs back, mm-hmm. which NAFTA has been a disaster.
So Bernie's not here defending himself from your sissy comment. I'm glad you said sissy and not something else. So he's not here to defend himself. But it is the case, and I said to him, that many of his supporters still have not gotten in line behind him right. in support of Hillary. But my point to you, though, is that even when you're Bernie Sanders, the perfect can't be the enemy of the good. I mean, he ran against her. She lost on many things. They do agree. Why is he a sissy to support Hillary Clinton?
Well, I would say one of the things that's, I mean, there's so many great things about Trump is it shows that the issues he's pushing are far more popular than the Republican Party. So mm-hmm. I would remind Democrats who have a difficult time pulling a lever for anyone with an R after his name. Remember that throughout the primaries, every Republican was going on TV to say, he's not a real Republican. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, more than half of America is saying, fantastic, he's not a real mm-hmm. Republican. Forget what the label is. He's the one who wants to renegotiate trade deals. He's the one who, he was right when he said the only time Hillary came out against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which will take any jobs that haven't been sent to Mexico and send them to Asia, she called it the gold standard of trade agreements. It was only when Trump raised it as an issue. And the same thing happened during the primaries with Republicans, you know, finally getting on board. That's what was so annoying. And, you know, I've been against this. This is not specific to these candidates or this election year. Right. I really do not like having media moderators. Lincoln and Douglas didn't have moderators. Let the candidates ask one another questions.
You didn't like Lester?
No, I thought the questions, I mean, at least it wasn't a talking snowman and transgender bathrooms. But if Trump has proved anything, it's that immigration is a really big issue and there isn't one question on immigration, not one. No, they'll save that for Mike Pence. It's not even his issue.
Yeah. So Trump, to my read, started out trying to be a little even keel. His tone was, you know, was pretty balanced and leveled. And I don't know whether Hillary baited him or not, but I'm sitting there watching it, watching him come out with this, you know, pretty steady performance in the first part of the debate. I'm thinking, there's no way that this guy can go for 90 minutes without coming off the rails. And sure enough, it was just a matter of time before the Donald that we've come to know showed up. You weren't bothered by that?
No, it wasn't too much. I mean, it wasn't like the crooked Hillary lion's head, which is more of a rally type thing.
Right.
I mean, the idea that he would do that in a debate, I think, was silly to imagine to begin with. But again, I think the important point is for the media and for Hillary, a win is not talking about the issues. I mean, I keep hearing from the media that Trump won't talk about policy specifics. I have a whole chapter on it in my book. He's the only one talking about policy specifics. And I went through and I read all the Republican primary debates. What was interesting about Trump, I mean, people always say they want a non-politician. Well, you got it with Donald Trump. Mm. And there's good to that and there's bad to that. The bad is that he can be distracted by talking about these stupid things that I promise you no one cares about his taxes. He will be gone. He will be dead and gone in 30 years. What kind of country this is?
You don't think the line that Hillary laid on him about his taxes, what he was hiding, he's not being charitable enough, he's not being rich enough, he's not paying taxes, you don't think that line was effective? About not releasing his taxes?
Only because it wasn't talking about how to bring jobs back. It wasn't talking about, she said she wants to amnesty all illegal aliens. Can we talk about how many they are? You know, from my last book, Adios America, I think they're more like 30, 40 million. How many crimes can they have committed? Three misdemeanors? That was Marco Rubio's amnesty bill. One vehicular homicide. What can we get any policy specifics from her on anything? He's telling us everything except the construction company that's going to supply the rebar.
And the response to that is, based upon what I've seen, what I've read, some people think that she was too policy driven. You think she wasn't policy driven? Every answer she gave, she just bore down perhaps on too many specifics, and you think she didn't do enough specifics?
It's
on
not
policy?
On policy. Yeah. No, she had lots of facts. She could be reciting facts for another 8 hours. She was very good at reciting facts. Yeah. I did think that was a little plastic and talking pointy, but she's talking about his father, a 1972 lawsuit, his taxes, what his income are. I wish, and I think a politician would have, on one hand, it's great that when he's asked a question, he actually answers it. And very few politicians do that. What they usually do is, as I describe in the book, is, which I never noticed before until I read through the debates, what they do is they repeat the question and then say people are frustrated. Trump, God bless him, hasn't learned to do that. He just says, this is how I'm going to bring jobs back.
The lawsuit issue that Hillary raised goes back to Bernie's point earlier about the bigotry when you don't want to release or rent to black people. That wasn't just a some just lawsuit you want to just throw out there. It was a lawsuit about racial discrimination, Ann.
Well, it was his father's company. They never admitted guilt. But if you look at his life, he has employed thousands upon thousands of black people. He has never been called a racist his entire life. He runs for public office. He could have run as a Democrat, I suppose. But he runs as a Republican. Suddenly, they call him a racist.
We might agree on this. You made a point about the media earlier. The one thing that I thought was just laughable was all of my friends and colleagues in the media who kept talking about the optics of this debate. I'm like, if you really believe that anybody's going to vote in this election, first of all, if his antics haven't shut him down, the optics sure the heck ain't gonna make a difference. But everybody kept talking about the optics, and he was sniffing, and he's this and that. Who cares? Do you really believe that anybody who believes in Donald Trump is gonna be swayed by his optics or his antics? And yet the mainstream media, my friends, just drone on and on about that.
Right. No, I agree with you, and I do think the only thing I wish you would keep in mind for the next debate is to learn this one politician's trick. Look, answer the question quickly. Say, this is a lie. I'm not going to waste time talking about this. Mm-hmm. This is about me personally. This really is the people against the powerful. It is the media. It is both political parties against Trump. And how is he communicating with people with these 30,000 person rallies through his Twitter account? They want to keep things going, business as usual. He's disrupting it.
The best example of short and pithy was when she was asked about the emails. Her answer was the shortest answer of the entire night. It was a mistake. I wouldn't do it again. Moving on.
Though his response was pretty good, too. I mean, to call that a mistake. That's the guy who falsely frames Dreyfus saying, oh, it was a mistake. No, you plotted, you thought, you planned. Yeah. Hired a firm to have bleach bit.
I'm out of time. We have two more debates to go with Donald and Hillary. You've just gave one piece of advice for him about how to answer questions. Anything else that he should hear from you about how to improve his performance over the next two debates?
The main thing is he always, and this has been true throughout his campaign, he wins when he talks about issues. The people are with him. The plutocrats aren't with him. The rich people, the businesses aren't with him, and the politicians aren't with him. But the people are with him on the issues. No one cares about his taxes.
Who wins in November?
I still think, I've thought from the beginning, and I haven't changed, 90% chance that Trump wins the nomination and 60% chance he wins the presidency.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Tandy Newton's work in film and TV includes the critically acclaimed hit Crash, W by Oliver Stone, The Pursuit of Happiness, which also starred Will Smith. Her latest role is in the HBO drama Westworld, based on the 1973 movie of the same name. It's a series about the dawn of artificial consciousness and the evolution of sin. She's here now to tell us more about the project, but first, here's a clip from Westworld.
You're new. Not much of a brand, are you? I'll give you a discount.
Well, no offense, but I'd rather earn a woman's affection than pay for it.
Well, you're always paying for it, darling. And the difference is our costs are fixed and posted right there on the door.
No truer words have ever been uttered.
You're paying for it one way or the other, I suspect. Your prices are just posted.
When I saw that you were playing a madam, I've always known you to play these really tough, gritty sort of characters. And how does this fit into your body of work?
The lexicon.
Yeah.
Oh, in the best way.
Yeah.
This is, I feel like I've been acting now for 25 years.
Can't believe it.
And
started when you were two.
Yeah. And this feels like the magnum opus. I would actually feel when I was on set that I didn't have to take off my women's rights hat. I wouldn't have to take off my human rights activist mm-hmm. hat. I didn't have to take off my, you know, rights for minors, young people mm-hmm. hat. And this is the stuff that matters more to me than anything.
Yeah.
And work, I'm not being cynical, but I have to find work that is allowing me to pay bills mm-hmm. and keep our, you know, lives going in a way that we're used to, and trying not to betray my political beliefs while I'm doing it. And listen, it's a tough thing to do as an yeah. actor. You only have a degree of control, but with Westworld, I was absolutely blown away when I first talked to Lisa Joy and Jonah Nolan at how ambitious they wanted Westworld to be in looking at the drives that are leading human beings over the cliff mm-hmm. of existence. You know, it's, for me, I feel like it's this kind of drive towards mass suicide, because so many of the problems that we're facing are interconnected, right. whether it's rape of women, rape of the environment, all of these factors suppressing life, suppressing joy, suppressing love are the things that will lead to our extinction.
Yeah.
Back up and unpack for me how it is that you, through this character, don't have to
leave
toss
my
those
activist
hats off.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, yeah. Well, because, and it was interesting for me on a personal level as well as a professional, but let me talk about the professional
sure,
first.
Sure,
That by playing a woman who is doing, is actually the instigator of sexual violence against women. Because whatever happens in Westworld stays in Westworld. So these prostitutes that are there for your benefit, mm-hmm. potentially, you can do whatever you want to them. If your appetite, you know, tips over into violence, murder even, no one's going to get to know about it. So in Westworld, you can do whatever you want. Let's not sit here, you and I, Tavis, now, and pretend that this does not happen in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Every, you know, look at the deep net, the dark net, or however you want to describe mm-hmm. it, the, you know, sex trafficking, pornography, terrible crimes committed by pederasts. This stuff is systemic. It's mm-hmm. it's actually, you know, it's just as much a part of our global economy as the transparent global economy, or so we think,
yeah.
you know, that's there. We have to start coming clean with ourselves. We have to start recognizing that every single one of us, every single one of us has the potential to be violent, has the potential to be cruel, has the potential to be destructive. It's about how we're brought up. It's about our education. It's about what abuse we've suffered. If we don't start getting wise to these things, we are going to end up pushing ourselves and everyone around us over the cliff edge.
And yet, how many times have you heard people say, I could never do that?
If you say
I
that,
could never do
is
that.
A very strong chance that you could. And
yeah.
this is, here's the thing.
Yeah.
If you respond to something with horror, I could never do that, what you're actually feeling is terrible fear that you could do that.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to allow our curiosity to lead to empathy. But we see, we're all, the construct, what we've created, the infrastructure that deals with crime, deals with sin,
mm-hmm.
is locked into, you know, hundreds, maybe even thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
And sin is the flip side to goodness, kindness. You know, it's the yin to the yang. We have to understand sin. Anthony Hopkins has a great line in the show, which is, in order to understand God, you have to be acquainted with the devil.
Mm-hmm.
We have to know these things, but there's a great deal of fear around wrongdoing because people die,
yeah.
people are horribly hurt, and it's a lot to be afraid of. So we tend not to want to look at the dark side.
Yeah.
But then if you don't look at the dark side, you find yourself suddenly in the dark side.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because look,
mm-hmm.
no matter how we try and protect ourselves from this and that, isn't it like life that stuff happens? You're like, mm-hmm. what was the whole point? How many people in America paid their payments, you know, month after month, and then there was the crisis with the banks and they've got no homes?
Mm-hmm.
How many people have been paying their insurance year after year and suddenly, you know, Obama brings in Obamacare? It's like, but I've been sacrificing all these years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is a degree of sacrifice. There is a degree of pain in understanding, you know, we can't control everything. And so we have to look at having greater awareness about who we are as a humanity and what we can do to prevent the things that motivate us to hurt each other, to lie to each other, to use each other, to get rich and obese on wealth that is of no service to humanity. You know, we're all locked into these things. We're ashamed of them. We hide them. There's corruption. You know, we're in a golden age, a platinum age. Let's go greater than gold. Where there is more transparency than ever before. You know, yes, we're, you know, WikiLeaks and you know, suppression of information it's over to a degree, you know. So what do we do with that? And that's what Westworld is really reflecting, is that we are in this time where people do whatever they want and then they get found out. So now that we know these things, now that we know we have this propensity for violence, for abuse, for destroying innocence, for destroying women, which is basically all leading to suicide, you know, destroying the environment, destroying the oceans, the fish, you know. Now that we know these things, we're so smart. We're as smart as the robots in Westworld because we program the robots. And what we see with Westworld, which is so incredible, is that when the robots get a sense of who they are and they've been actually programmed to be abused, my character is programmed to just use my girls like a factory farm of sex. Once my character realizes that I've been programmed to do it, not only do I realize it's just about the most ignorant, pathetic thing to do because it's gonna end up with suicide of the population. And okay, I need to teach these humans to program themselves and artificial intelligence a bit better. That's the premise. So I play a madam in order to then look at what that means. And that is the premise of Westworld. We have to show it so that we can then speak about it, be honest about it, see the consequences, the ramifications, because that's key, isn't it? If we look at the dark side, if we just hold hands and peer in and help each other not to be afraid of what we're seeing in ourselves, maybe we can do something about it. It's never going to be perfect, whatever that means, you know. And I just feel like there's so much hanging over from the past, whether it's literature, whether it's policies, whether it's great men and women from the past that have said certain things. If we don't update, if we don't update our information, we're not living in the current real world. We have to update information.
So I'm tickled on the inside because you explained this so brilliantly and so beautifully. And only in Hollywood could you take all that and find some entertainment value in it.
Well, otherwise no one's going to watch, babe.
That's my point.
No one's going to watch.
That's what cracks me up. I mean, I love watching stuff that both empowers me and entertains me. I love watching stuff that challenges me to re-examine my assumptions, to expand my inventory of ideas, and yet entertain me at the same time. That's not always easy to do in this business, though.
Well, it's like food, you know. Yes, we can just eat food in order to nourish our bodies, but if we put a little spice in there, if we put a little love in there, it's going to taste better and still nourish us. It's the same thing. It'll be more memorable if we do it like that. Maybe your kids will want to come home to have that delicious food if we spice it right. That's my, I guess, my analogy for entertainment, you know. And it's, but we mustn't allow entertainment, I mean, I say we mustn't, but you know, it's going to happen, and it is already happening. Entertainment is also mass production in the same way. I'm talking about food, that spice, Tavis, those beautiful dishes that you remember your mother making, your father making, your aunt, whatever. Or is it mass-produced food that you don't know where it's from? It's, and, well, this is what I mean about the intersectionality of everything, the interconnectedness. We're forgetting that a meal can change everything, the smells, it can evoke something from the past that matters to you, that you love. And that's what marketing's all about, is making you feel like that fast food is giving you what mama made you and all this nonsense, when actually we're just being lied to so that we can just reach into our pockets and pay the money. We have all the power. Us consumers have all the power. And if we can show that, hey, I want transparency, hey, I want something that's gonna be nutritious and great, then suddenly kale will be all over the marketplace, and turmeric will be everywhere.
God help me if kale's everywhere.
Look, kale's been everywhere, babe. There are sweatshirts saying kale.
What kale is going on?
Literally, when I saw a sweatshirt that said Kale University, I was like, okay, kale has definitely swept the planet.
I've tried it 18 million different ways, and I can't do the kale thing.
Well, listen, this is something that, again, let's just talk about kale for a second, all right? Yes, it's good for you. Yes, it's got nutritional value and so on. But this is just what I mean about intersectionality and about us waking up and please, please, we deserve answers that are honest and real. I was on set last year, and I was talking to some, you know, guys in the crew about what they did for the weekend, and this guy was saying, oh, I did a bit of gardening on the weekend, and, oh, that kale, you can't get rid of it. It's just once it's in the ground, it doesn't want to go. I said, seriously?
Yeah.
He said, yes, just like a weed, you just can't get rid of it. I said, well, that's why we've been told that kale's the best thing to eat, because it's easy to grow, you cannot get rid of it, it's hardy in difficult environments, and you can sell it for a hell of a lot more money than it costs to produce. Now, what I'm not saying that kale's bad. Look, kale's great.
Yeah.
But we are sold ideas that we think we invented, but we're being programmed. Everything we see, every marketing, and it's clever, and we are brilliant. People are so, so clever. But it's about using that clever to promote love, to promote community, to promote protection of the young, to promote protection of women, because they are literally the future of humanity. Look, maybe a lot of human beings don't want to live, so let's just forget about protecting women and children. Let's just forget about it. It doesn't matter, you know? But that says something too. That says something too. How bankrupt are we? If our souls are bankrupt that we don't want to ensure the world for the next seven generations. That's so sad.
How are we being fellow citizens, being programmed in this election season to the extent that you think we are being programmed?
Well, this is the interesting thing. This is looking underneath the programming, isn't it? I was watching the debate too. It's all there for us to see. You know, that's as honest as that's gonna get. You know, and there are a lot of lies being told, and not just lies, I wrote that in a tweet. Now I don't write that, you know, I don't think that anymore. So it's not like things are necessarily hidden. So it's about the choices we make, you know. So in that, as an example that you were saying, you know, about the election process, and let's talk about the debate. How does that work as a program? Okay, so there is literally a program there. We see it. We take that programming and we add it to our program. If we are people who are frustrated and we have, if the rhetoric that we hear corresponds with our fear, our sadness, our, you know, it's great marketing, we're gonna say, yes, you. If your history, Hillary Clinton, corresponds with my education meant everything to me, my children, you know, supporting my husband, then are we gonna vote for Hillary? It's about tapping into whatever programming is already in you. Okay, so it's, what I'm saying is, we're not all robots, of course we're not, but if we're aware that we are being influenced every day, let's be really clear that that's happening, and let's make some choices based on what we think. And look, a lot of us are making choices, but we're not being heard. You know, I remember marching because I didn't want, you know, Britain to go to Iraq, and I was in a march with my little girl on my shoulders, my husband, there were a million of us walking through London. I was thinking, this is going to do something. This is a peaceful demonstration. It did nothing.
Yeah.
What that does to the psychology of an entire country, of the world, that you're not heard, and the suspicion that I vote in this way and nothing's happening. That suspicion leads to mass fear, suspicion, and you know there's a lot to prove that suspicion and fear is actually makes a group of people easier to control.
Sure.
So let's not try and correct that fear and suspicion, because you know they're easy targets when they're afraid. So let's all, how can we not be afraid? By getting to know each other. Because you're afraid of what you don't know. That's what you're afraid of. You can just sense something's not right, because we're really clever and we're really intuitive human beings. So we can sense there's something wrong. If we're given programming that says, it's the people next door who don't look like you, they're responsible for everything that's wrong, then we're gonna believe it. And we're gonna attack those people. And we're gonna be busy doing that while they're off out trading in arms and money and grossness that we then have to, sorry, it makes me so cross, that we then have to admit, well, that's my country doing that. Mm-hmm. We're all the same and we all want the same thing. We all want to be secure. We all want food on the table. We want to know that our kids aren't going to be destroyed when they're not with us. We all want the same things. And if we've been hurt in our childhoods, we try and recreate the same hurt. We try and recreate the same hell because that's the only thing that we believe is true.
Mm. I'm listening to you as I always do. And every time you come on, I'm always so empowered and enlightened.
Very flattering because you do the same for so many people.
I appreciate that. But I mean, I always learn from you. I learn from you all the time. And I'm challenged by you. So I'm trying to process how you process this as an artist, mm-hmm. so that your role, your calling, mm-hmm. your vocation,
yes. How is
your
it?
Avocation in the world yeah. is to express this through your art.
Yes.
How do you put that together for me?
Well,
it must be tough for you to choose roles when you're this enlightened about the world and the way you see the world.
Well, I just think I've been in a very lucky situation, and a lot of what I've come to understand has been through the harsh knocks that my business has given me. Mm-hmm. I call it my business, yeah. Okay? And also life, the harsh knocks of life. And also I haven't felt that I've been able to learn through my work. It's not strictly through the work, through mm-hmm. the script and so on. Mm-hmm. It's been more about the people I've met sure. and the environments and that creativity, which tends to do away with a creative environment tends to do away with any kind of prejudice mm-hmm. of the people involved, because difference is actually recognized as a good thing. Makes you stand out. It means you have value in the group. It's a more dynamic group if you've got difference in there, which is true for life, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But with Westworld, it was the distillation of so many of the things that I've come to value, which is the search for the truth. The search for the truth. It's been incredibly important in my life personally. Incredibly important. Once I understood that X, Y, and Z led to this unhappiness here and my feelings of deep insecurity and shame and so on, as I unpicked it and just saw the reality that everyone's doing their best, no one's to blame, I'm free. I'm free from that programming that I didn't have any influence mm-hmm. over, right? I'm not angry. I'm a bit angry about some things, mm-hmm. but I try and change that anger to energy, to just keep pushing forward, to encourage people to not to be afraid of the truth and to recognize that they're not alone. And that is what I can do with my work, without yeah. a doubt, getting into the homes of people. But then I have found oftentimes I've been involved in projects that I think have actually betrayed those mm-hmm. important things. And what I do then is I just remove myself if I can, mm-hmm. because I'm, you know, I have the benefit that, you know, I won't get sacked on the spot because mm-hmm. I'm in the movie or mm-hmm. the show or whatever. So I can, you know, I have more authority to be able to make certain changes. Mm-hmm. And if I can't do that just because it's betraying my sure. politics, you know, my belief, then I'll try and remove myself. But it's tough. And more I've been moving to writing. I've written, yeah. you know, a project that I want to direct. And I thought that was my future,
yeah.
was writing and talking, speaking, directing.
Yeah.
But with Westworld, it's been really shocking to yeah. me that it's been a place where I feel, basically Lisa Joy and Jonah Nolan, we have the same, it feels like we have the same desire to look into the mirror.
Yeah, I hear that and I feel that, and one can see that when they see the series on HBO, Westworld. You mentioned the word truth two or three times. What I have been struggling with so much of late mm. is what happens when you inhabit a world mm. where there is less and less value placed on truth.
Yes.
And that's the part that's getting scary for me.
Oh, my goodness,
we see it playing out in so many different ways where there's just less value
absolutely.
Placed on truth.
Well, because here's the thing.
Yeah.
The truth, there's versions of it.
Of course.
You look at any kind of criminal case, mm-hmm. you know, your truth is going to be different to my truth. But we're talking about truths about things happening. When I talk about truth, I'm talking about the bigger truth, which is how, you know, is our fear of the unknown, our fear of the great unknown, which is obviously death, and how that motivates us in everything we do. That's what I'm talking about. And there are different versions for people, you know, whether it's, you know, different religions, philosophies, and so on. And then we get so addicted to that that then we start fighting with each other when we're all just trying to do the same thing, which is to find a way to calm our nerves about the undisputed, you know, end to our lives.
Yeah, I would just
and that's what it's all about, you know. And I don't think anybody would argue with that.
Yeah, I don't think so. I was just giving a talk about this the other day, about this notion of truth, and as I was saying earlier,
it's the great truth. Yeah, and here's the thing about truth, Tavis. Yeah. This is, I read this recently, and it just blew my mind. You don't have to believe in the truth because it's the truth.
Yeah, yeah. My mother says it all the time.
You don't need belief. As soon as you say, I believe, as soon as someone's saying, I believe, be wary. Yeah. Because you don't have to bang someone over the head with your beliefs. Because the truth, the real truth, the fundamental truth doesn't have to be believed. It's the truth.
My mother says this all the time. She's been telling me since I was a kid, and I've come to believe this since I was literally 5 or 6, that the truth, this is George Smiley's original, that the truth needs no defense.
It doesn't need any defense.
The truth,
what a beautiful thing.
Never, ever needs
a defense. Oh, your mum is awesome.
She says it all the time.
She's amazing, babe.
Well,
that's your mama.
So are you.
That's your mother.
You're pretty amazing.
What an amazing woman.
I love
Seriously.
Her. I love her dearly. And your children are blessed, all three of them, to have you as their mother. So,
I love my babies.
Yeah, I know
we
you
all
do.
Love our babies.
And we love Tandy. The new show is called Westworld. It's on HBO. And as I said earlier in this conversation, I am always enlightened, empowered, inspired when she shows up on this program. So much insight. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Ellis Hall, the former lead vocalist and keyboardist for Tower of Power, known as the Ambassador of Soul, has performed with a multitude of musical icons, including Stevie Wonder, James Taylor, and his musical mentor, Ray Charles. He's also played with some of the world's best orchestras and has created his own symphony shows. His latest is called Soul Unlimited. He joins us now to talk about the new project.
I think there's so many people who have heard your voice on soundtracks, on TV commercials. Where have you been all these years, for those who've never heard the name Ellis Hall?
Well, you know, I had a bit of visibility with a group called the Tower of Power.
Absolutely.
And after that, I started doing television and movies, behind the scenes, but always there. Now, I made an appearance in the movie Big Mama's House, and folks saw me as the organist pop up and act a fool. You know, and the operative word is F-O-O apostrophe, fool.
Yeah, yeah.
So, after saying that, I've just been around doing what I do through the grace of God, recording, performing, writing, singing. I'm so honored to be this vessel.
Yes. Tell me about your friendships with two other great artists who happen to have been sightless.
Yes, sir.
Stevie Wonder and your friend Ray Charles. Tell me about your friendship with Stevie and Ray.
Well, one thing's for sure is, yes, we do talk about driving cars.
Yeah.
No. Stevie, love, what a spirit. I mean, and Ray. Ray, if he didn't think you were bringing it, he would lay you out. But if he felt you were coming to the highest highs with your A game, he would exalt you. And, you know, that's the thing of working with Ray, especially for the last few years of his life. He called me his protege, but as I lovingly say, George Benson got a hold of him and said, I had him first.
Yeah.
But working with Ray and Stevie, bottom line.
And being on Ray's label.
Oh, yeah, and absolutely signed to, I was the last one besides Ray, actually on his label, Crossover Records. And Ray would say to me, boy, you got so much music in you, it's scary. And I called him Papa Ray. I said, look who's talking, Papa Ray. But we happen to have a couple of things in common, Ray and I. One was having had vision and lost it and seeing the red clay of Georgia and the great commonness of how we loved our mothers.
Yeah.
You know, we had that. And then he said to me, he said, Ellis, you need to be doing symphonies. And I said, now, Papa Ray, it would be great. How do I do it? Mm-hmm. He made a couple of phone calls and the rest is history. Wow. And the symphonies, my brother, one show running called Ellis Hall presents Ray, Motown, and Beyond. Mm-hmm. So I take all these songs and Ellisize them. Mm-hmm. The second one.
I like that, Ellisize them.
That's right. And the second one is Ellis Hall Soul Unlimited.
What is an Ellis Hall symphony like?
Well,
what's the evening like?
It's 81-piece orchestras. And I get them, you know, they read what's on the ink, but right. I get them to jam with me.
Right.
I get them to say, okay, we're taking a song like Higher and Higher, Jackie Wilson, mm-hmm. and take it to another level. And I get so excited, I start jumping up and down.
Let me go back to a point you made earlier, Ellis, when you talked about some of the things that you and Ray had in common.
Yes, sir.
Both of you were born with sight.
Yes, sir.
And went blind. Tell me the Ellis Hall story of going blind.
Well, it was at 18, okay, first of all, a year into my birth, my mom and pops noticed that my eyes were developing differently. First of all, from brown, they turned to blue. What had happened, congenital glaucoma, which I tell everybody, get checked. Mm-hmm. Glaucoma has no symptoms. Please get checked to keep the pressure down. So they noticed, and I was born in Savannah, Georgia, raised partway in Claxton, mm-hmm. and they said, what are we going to do? My mom used to cry at night. What are we going to do to get my baby to make his own way? They had the brilliant thought to move me up to Boston, Massachusetts, but going to a school called Perkins. Please let me give a special shout out to the amazing programs at Perkins School for the Blind, where Miss Helen Keller and others have developed their great skills of interdependence. Mm-hmm. And also a shout to my dear friend, Mr. Kevin Bright. He's a co-creator of Friends. We've known each other a while. And he has made some amazing programs over there. Again, to show that nothing stops us but us. But having said that, I used to wrestle and play football. They didn't tell me I shouldn't be doing contact sports. Mm-hmm. So at 18, a gentleman hit my good eye, my left eye, by accident. And I always tell friends lovingly, oh, come on, the real deal is I didn't pay my electric bill on time, so lights out. You know, come on.
How do you process, though? How do you process being able to see
and then
for
not,
18 years and then not?
Because I remember what I call the important things, looking at the pretty ladies and sunsets.
Yeah, in that order, huh?
Yeah. And I used to, because they told me that my sight could go away at any time, I used to practice my instruments in the dark. Once I learned I was going to be in this music madness,
yeah.
I learned how to play drums, basses, guitars, keyboards, whatever it took. In fact, I was doing the beatbox way before they thought it was the beatbox, because I don't mess up the mic like, you know, that kind of vibe. Yeah. Come on now.
I love this. I am fascinated. As long as I've known you, I never knew this story. So when you knew you were going to go blind,
yes, sir.
You literally started practicing all your instruments in the dark?
Yes, I would literally, for instance, my bass, I would take it and stand, I'd turn, you know, the lights off, or I'd stand in a closet so I wouldn't disturb anyone. So I'd play it over and over, literally, until my fingers bled, so I could get to know the instrument by feeling. For instance, when I go to someone's drum set, mm-hmm. I'll feel it for about 2 seconds or 3 seconds and try and play it like it's my own.
Mm. Wow.
That's what it does. Nothing. I call myself the poster boy of PPD, perseverance, persistence, and determination. Hallelujah. Mm.
Yeah. What role? I've known you for so long, so I know you to be a person of faith.
Yes.
What role has your faith played in helping you navigate this peculiar journey?
Well, it's knowing, first of all, in learning that I become the vessel, I know that that power that is behind this vessel never fails. So all I have to do through any peaks and valleys in my life, keep walking, keep laughing, keep loving, keep letting people know, without a doubt, I have the choice to wake up smiling. We all have that choice to wake up smiling, mm-hmm. or as I say, wake up and be on the other side of the bed as a snarkosaurus.
Yeah.
We do. We have that choice. So I'd rather get up and smile. It doesn't mean that my day won't be bad. I can recognize that, but thank God, the attitude of gratitude, thanking God that I'm here, standing, walking, and can celebrate my day, and maybe somebody else who might want to celebrate with me.
Yeah. See, that's amazing that somebody else might want to celebrate with you, because
yes.
I have never, and I mean this sincerely,
yes, sir.
As many times as I have seen you or talked to you or hung out with you or even yes. gotten voicemail messages,
yeah.
which I get from you routinely, and I love hearing them, I've never known you to be in a bad mood. I mean, every time I see you, you always lift my spirits and everybody's around you, but you gotta have some bad days though, man.
Well, you know, the cheapest therapy, brother.
Yeah.
This little thing right here.
Okay.
You know, just,
all right.
You know, how can you, if you, I mean, you can't feel bad.
Yeah.
If you're ringing the fire alarm,
yeah.
come on.
Yeah.
You can't help yourself.
Yeah.
You know, the train's coming through.
Yeah.
You have a choice to get on the train or get out the way, because yeah. it's going to come.
Yeah.
And that's what I say. I tell you, take folks on a journey, be it symphonies or our festival gigs with the band.
Yeah.
We're going to, you know, we're going to make you shout,
yeah.
you know. And if we're singing a slow song, you know, if you're with someone special, you want to hold them close enough,
yeah.
you know, leaving enough room for the Holy Ghost.
Yeah. Tell me about this unique gift you have, and there are a lot of artists who have it,
yes.
who can take a song and cover it. But you don't just take a song and cover it. To use your word, you elicize it.
That's right.
Tell me how when you hear a song, you know whether or not it is a potential to be elicized.
Well, you know, that goes back to Ray.
Mm-hmm.
Ray was not afraid of doing country music.
Yeah.
And back then, folks. Black folks in country music?
Yeah.
That was unheard of.
Yeah.
Modern sounds of country turned the music industry on its ear.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having said that, if I hear a song like the song I've just performed,
yeah.
I really want to see it tonight.
Yeah.
It used to be called I'd Really Love to See It Tonight. Mm-hmm. England Janet, John Ford Coley.
Oh, great song.
And
yeah.
Parker McGee,
mm-hmm.
a dear friend. I called him up and I played it over the phone, and he was crying like a baby because he said, because I said, if you slow that down
yeah.
and make it a love soul ballad,
yeah.
and you can make anything a soul situation, thereby the title Ellis Hall, Soul Unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
Take songs that you don't regularly think are soul and make them your own. And that moment that song came from had already been created. So
yeah.
why create the same moment?
Mm-hmm.
Why not create a new one? A
different moment, yeah.
Yes.
In case you have never heard, well, you've heard him before, whether you know it or not. In case you never knew his name,
yes.
Ellis Hall, you should do what some of my staff have already done. Just go online and
yes.
Google Ellis Hall, and you can get a good feel of all kind of stuff that he's done that you can find online. But if
at
you stay,
www.ellishall.com.
Dude, you got about, I was about to hit it. He's going to close us out with an original song. Here
yes.
comes Ellis Hall performing Girl, You're Not in Kansas Anymore.
Storytelling time about a friend of mine, all right. Good God. Standing by the highway, gonna do it her way, hitching a ride on anything out of town. She's LA bound. Flagging down a diesel, hanging with the weasel, let her off somewhere in the desert sun. She wouldn't give him some now.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing, or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsi Abuadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.